When you talk about being purpose-led, it really does translate pan-sector and it materializes differently for different companies.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-led communications agency Higginson Strategy, and I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you honestly and passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you, your passion becomes theirs, and I call this the power of purpose. Today, I'm joined by Beth Knight, Head of Social Sustainability at Lloyds Banking Group. Beth is a leading figure in the social impact and sustainability space with more than 15 years of experience overseeing sustainable business initiatives at Accenture, EY, and Amazon, among others. She was named Great British Businesswoman of the Year in 2022. She's a seasoned expert at driving purpose-driven change and also serves as a senior associate at the University of Cambridge's Institute for Sustainability Leadership. She chairs the Corporate Advisory Board of Save the Children and was appointed as a NED of Visit Britain. Sorry, that's a non-executive director. Beth, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show today. Tell us a bit more about your journey to where you are today.
Thank you. I always kind of feel like a bit of an imposter when people start rattling off that long list of projects that I'm working across. But I'm basically from Cornwall. I'm a Cornish girl. I made my way to university on a scholarship, a sports scholarship, and have grown my impact and fallen forward in my purpose, I would say. So I come from a family where my father was a fireman, my mum was a hustler, but very kind of purpose-led people. And so you can sort of see that in how my career journey has gone, albeit a squiggly one. Starting off at Accenture, I was working in strategic IT and started looking at and applying technology to nonprofit sector, working with clients like Oxfam, starting to kind of work in disaster relief context using tech. And then I found myself at Amazon at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, where I was leading a team doing some very cool things. Sad that it was needed, but for example, helping to deliver COVID-19 test kits to homes across the UK, working with a wonderful charity called Magic Breakfast, helping deliver food to children at risk of malnutrition because they weren't getting free school meals in UK lockdowns. My last year there, I led a piece of work building out a humanitarian aid function in response to the Ukraine war. And then more recently, as of April this year, I've found myself at Lloyds Banking Group, partly a personal choice because I wanted to be more UK focused in my work, but also because I think the bank is doing some very interesting activity around helping Britain prosper at the interconnect of like the role of financial institutions and access to finance for underrepresented groups in society.
So can you elaborate on Lloyds' mission as you see it and your kind of specifically your corporate social responsibility mission?
Oh, of course. Yeah. So Lloyds Banking Group's purpose statement is helping Britain prosper. So within that context, there's a number of pillars around how that's brought to life and what the role of the bank is, essentially. The way that I like to think about it in my day job is essentially the role of the bank in solving for market failure, where customers have access to finance challenges, where you've got vulnerable customers that need additional support, and where we've got a role as a bank in a financial institution in advocating for underserved and underrepresented communities.
And what's your specific job then at Lloyds? Because it's a different job title than lots of people might have. What does it specifically involve?
Yeah, I think that's the right question to ask, really, because when people say I work in sustainability, it can mean any number of things. And throughout my career, I constantly find that has evolved and changed depending on the role and the organisation or what's happening in the market at any given time. I'm essentially focused on underserved business communities right now. So I'm looking at things like advocating for black businesses in the UK, helping female founders scale and grow their business impact, and excitingly off the back of something called the Lilac Review, We're looking at advocacy and improved access to finance for disabled entrepreneurs. So working from a point of accessibility, but also helping scale and helping to think about things like adaptive finance, where not just for disabled entrepreneurs, but at any point in time, any of us in life might find ourselves in situations where we need to take a break from payments on a loan, for example, or we need access to further credit, etc. We have life events, we might have health concerns, etc., which means that we need increasingly more levels of flexibility from banks. We need banks that really understand and engage with communities and the different needs of different communities, as we have quite a diverse population in the UK, and increasingly so. Lloyds have done some really exciting and interesting things. Like, you can see the response that they've had to the influx of Ukraine refugees in the UK. They've been one of the quickest banks at helping to open accounts for those sorts of populations. But then also we've been advocating very heavily for things like a disability finance code to help entrepreneurs really know what they can ask of financial institutions and how banks like ours can and should be leaning in to help with access to finance needs.
How's your background in those really big, well-known consultancies like Accenture and EY? How does that help you in your job as you're in today?
I think when you, so I started my career in consulting. And so very early in my career, I was exposed to lots of different organizations. I was doing lots of strategy design and implementation projects. Sometimes I was seconded in-house. Sometimes I was working as an external advisor in. And I think when you get that level of exposure to business transformation at scale and pace, and applying what might be business theory or academic frameworks actually in practical contexts, you learn a lot in the process of doing that. And I think it's given me a unique perspective. I've been working in sustainability and business transformation now for over 15 years in different contexts. And having seen what works practically and pragmatically in large organizations, how that then generates scale and a halo effect of impact to businesses within the value chains of the larger multinationals, that's quite powerful. And it's why I continue to kind of build my career and focus on working with larger organizations in order to affect change and support for smaller businesses.
I mean, I really now, as a business owner of a consultancy, really respect the large management consultancies. Whereas when I was a journalist, I thought, like a lot of people, that, you know, consultants come in, and I couldn't really work out why they were paid and why they were paid so much money and why people would do it. And the one thing I've really learned from the way that they work is just that holding feet to the fire. And I think there's a huge amount you can learn from the ability to set very, very, be very goal or orientated, mm-hmm. and set very clear KPIs. And once you do that, and it's something I'll try and do within Higgins and Strategy, the consultancy I run. I mean, I have a bit like a kind of sales team. We've got KPIs written up on the wall for every single client, and those are from the contracts, because quite often if you don't do that, meetings can run on and people can say, oh yes, we're doing a strategy and it's doing this, that and the other. And that's certainly one bit that I think people from consultancies have an advantage there from people that haven't had that consultancy background. Do you agree with that?
I think that it helps. It's like a muscle you have to train. I wouldn't say that those that work in-house don't have it, but I think it's a muscle you use often when you're working in consulting. So you're essentially going to be exceptional at problem solving, because you're going to be brought in because there's a specific challenge or there's something really noodly or multipolar and complex that they need somebody that thinks three-dimensionally to get their heads around, and that has a lot of external perspective, and quite often that is consultants. And I think the best consultants that I've seen and worked with have been those that are problem solvers, that are goal orientated. I think having that laser focus, be it through a KPI stuck on your wall or really holding yourself to a contract, is how you get a really good kind of impact from your work. I saw this as well working in-house at Amazon. So Amazonians are very focused on working backwards from goals, extremely goal-orientated, at stretching above and beyond just a goal, I would say, as well. So yes, that might be the objective or the equivalence of a KPI in the contract, but what is it that the customer needs? How can you be customer obsessed? How can you work backward from that need? And I've learned a huge amount from both those work environments, and then applying those to, you know, if your customer is the most underserved or a underserved person within an economic or a social context, how do you work backwards from that? And their journeys are often the most complex and the most broken because they're not the people that the system that we're operating within it was designed for. And so for me, in being purpose-led and choosing to think about social sustainability through that lens and prioritise my work there, that's enabled me to truly advocate for customers that can benefit from those skills.
And are you therefore kind of practicing a form of positive discrimination there? So if you've been set a goal and you've said, well, we want more black-owned businesses and we want to attract more black-owned businesses or disabled-owned businesses, what are you doing differently to attract more of those? Is it different standards being set there to achieve that?
Yeah, so I don't know whether it's not necessarily about attracting them. I think that they're there anyway, right? So it's more about understanding what are the needs and requirements of those groups. Quite often in large banks and financial institutions, you're looking at large data sets of customers and you can't always see and understand a lived experience of a customer, right? So unless the customer decides to tell you, I'm a black business owner and this is my experience, or I'm disabled and these are my support needs, it's very difficult for a bank to operate at scale and make large decisions on customer journeys for really nuanced use cases. And so my role is really to be an intrapreneur in that context, so to take entrepreneurial skill sets, bring them in-house, and to advocate for the needs of those customers. So in instances where we don't have the data, so for example, if we don't have ethnicity data on customers, I can only help our development teams or our relationship managers to really understand the customer by bringing through stories, lived experience. Lloyd's have breakthrough solutions for things like this. We've got something called the Black Business Advisory Committee, which is quite a unique thing where there's a steering group there essentially that are external to Lloyd's. They hold us to account. They work very closely with us and they advocate for the needs of black business owners in the UK. Now, that isn't a story that's always told in data. And so you need to have that catalyst, that individual or team or responsibility that kind of interplays with the larger organisational entity that is Lloyd's Bank.
Great. And then how might a black business be different in terms of a different financial need to another business?
Well, so there's the socioeconomic points around unconscious bias or sometimes overt biases that by virtue of a racial difference that a business owner is exposed to. And I'm assuming that anyone listening can understand where social justice and racial bias issues might come in, be it to a business owner or just a lay person. So there's that element of it. What you also see in the black business community is quite often they're starting their businesses with investment from family. They're more likely to go to family for startup capital than they would to a bank or a financial institution. Quite often where you've got black business owners that are also working across borders, sometimes they're referred to as diaspora businesses. So for example, if they're bridging into the US or black communities in Africa, they have distinct challenges around supply chain, working across borders, etc. And so you have to kind of consider that in how you're thinking about their needs as distinct. And at times there's also trust issues there. We did a really good report a couple of years ago off the back of some really deep consultation with Black entrepreneurs. And that report was great. It was really enlightening. We shared it. It was open sourced. But just producing reports, you know, that raises awareness. But actually, so what are you going to do about it? That's where the rubber hits the road. And what I really respect about Lloyds and why I happily joined was they're not just talking about it, they're actually doing it. And my job is to make sure that we are doing it. And so that's where I can get really excited about the impact that I have, because it's not just about sharing data or publishing reports or talking with government. It's actually rolling our sleeves up and like looking at what are the customer journeys, what's the impact there, how are we thinking about that with how we're improving digital journeys and access to finance and all these sorts of things. And that's how I get to spend my day, which is quite cool.
Great. Higgins & Strachey works with a number of purpose-led organisations. Are there any that you know about and admire?
Oh, there's many. There's many out there. I used to have a job when I was at Ernst & Young where I was head of strategy for something called a purpose-led business think tank. And so I had the opportunity to be a bit of a voyeur writing case studies and exploring what companies are doing around being purpose-led. Funnily enough, it's the examples of where companies are getting it wrong that sort of stick with you. Benefit corporations are often a good place to look for purpose-led organisations, because by virtue of being a B Corp, they think about the environmental and social impact of what they're doing. Community interest companies are also growing in the UK. Social enterprises are growing in the UK. So seeing the impact of those business models has been fascinating. And what you often see is you've got these large, more incumbent brands that are then looking at these really kind of purpose-led organisations and brands and figuring out, well, what are they getting right? What are we getting wrong? What do we need to do about this? And sometimes you see that in mergers and acquisitions. So like the famous example was L'Oreal buying Body Shop, and then Natura buying Body Shop from L'Oreal and all these sorts of things. And so there are some good purpose-led brands that lay consumers would identify with. I also really enjoy looking at what some of the larger multinationals are doing. GSK has some amazing humanitarian aid work that they're doing around pharmaceuticals and their health agenda. Unilever has a great reputation for, you know, building in within its sub brands aspirations and goal performances that are linked to their purpose. Lego is talked about a lot. With their also their commitment in learning through play, and they've got some great interlock there with their Lego Foundation work, but also really thinking about their responsibility in terms of like getting off plastics and experimenting with AI tools to repurpose and take back bricks and rebuild new things with them rather than creating new bricks. So when you talk about being purpose-led, it really does translate pan-sector, and it materializes differently for different companies.
Yeah, absolutely. And we work with B Lab UK, which is the organisation that certifies B Corps in the UK, and the UK is the largest. Well, London is the largest city of B Corps in the world, which we're very very proud of in the UK. Right. And that problem that you identified there, when what happens when a B Corp is taken over by another company, is one that they really grapple with, because as you point out there, mergers and acquisitions happen in the business world, and the acquirer hasn't always got the same values as the company that's been acquired. So that's a kind of constantly evolving one about what actually ultimately happens to a company once
I think I have so much respect for marketing and communications, PR and public policy professionals, because throughout my career, I've needed them as my partners and ally, because quite often what I find is you can have a purpose statement and it looks really good. But where the rubber hits the road is, okay, well, how do you bring that to life through stories? How do you articulate what sometimes is quite a complicated strategy in a way that is kind of simple that the customer can understand it, but that also the business can then take and then start to implement. And so that interplay between corporate affairs and communications and then sustainability practitioners who are sort of in the business doing the transformation work, which is ultimately where that's what I do, that works best when you are walking side by side and kind of in close partnership, because you can only tell a story as well as the things that, you know, sustainability professionals are delivering. And we don't want to over-index on storytelling and be at risk of spin, be it greenwash, purpose wash, purple wash, you know, any colour of wash. And so that point around integrity and, you know, the delivery and the execution of what the organisation is doing is just as critical.
Yeah. Have you ever had an instance where delivery and execution haven't quite matched up and you've kind of slightly put your head in your hands and thought, we got this one a bit wrong?
Not that I can share outside of an NDA, but there's an example that we use. So you mentioned that I'm a fellow at Cambridge Institute of Sustainability Leadership. And so one of the debates that we often have been around tobacco industry and defence sector. So, you know, Philip Morris International, British American Tobacco, they're often kind of referred to as like, can those organisations really be purpose-led? What does that mean when your product sort of has health considerations? How do you engage and do the ethical tussle when you're in that sort of sector? And equally in defence. So, you know, defence quite often comes from a kind of perception of war and working in deficit with
One that has really changed over the last few years, and as a result of Ukraine, you know, and I think there was always this assumption that any defense company was bad, and now I don't think anyone that has seen what's been going on in Ukraine could argue for a moment that the defence industry is all negative, and so that's
100% agree. And I think we saw that this year in the King's speech, where he was talking about three priorities around climate change, empowering regions and, you know, regional communities in the UK, and then also considering defence and the context of defence within protection, within. How we're leaning into defence for technologies that we're needing to accelerate on things like advanced manufacturing, which is helping with our transition to net zero in the UK, how we're thinking about extreme weather events, coastal erosion, humanitarian conflict. And defence sector has a massive role to play in all of that stuff, and we really need them for that. One of the pieces of work that I do in a coaching capacity is I've worked with female leaders in kind of cross-military coaching environments, and I'm constantly fascinated by how they're looking at the acceleration of AI, like in tech for good use cases, where they're building out advanced manufacturing hardware and software solutions for defence, but then they're actually looking at, well, how do we open source the IP of these things? How can they be used for multiple use cases? And I think that's wonderful, and I think we need more of that, because we need to just throw everything that we can at protecting planetary boundaries at the moment, right? And so if that helps, then great.
Yeah, and if you look at almost all of the biggest steps forward in human technology advancements, they've all been on the back of defence things. So the TV invented by Yogi Bird was a Second World War invention. Was it First or Second World War? Internet, you know, all these things, mostly, you know, radiography, all these things were massively brought forward. All the communications tools were, you know, designed quite often for war. And those,
yeah, I mean,
those
so, sometimes I don't know all of those examples, but like the internet, for example, like the World Wide Web launched at UCL, right? And a lot of the research funding came from UK government. The decision to kind of open source it was ultimately Berners-Lee, right? That was he's credited with that decision. I think where the rubber hits the road is what subsequent application of these things are, right? So a tool is only ever as good as the human hands that it's in. So when we talk about AI now, for example, and we've had lots of debate around, you know, is AI a good thing, is a bad thing? How do you use it for different use cases? The famous example, I don't know if you've been following the feminist Alexa movement, which has been talking about a lot of the audio AI has got women's voices. And that decision has been taken because it's less scary than a robotic voice, and it's feminine and it's softer. And but at the same time, there's been psychology studies that show that children are now using kind of command language in interacting with women, because when they're interacting with the AI, it's, you know, Siri, do this, Alexa, do that. Yeah. It's a directional communication. Mm. And so you have to understand.
And it's a servant role, isn't it? You know, AI as a servant. So that's, yeah.
That's very well put, yeah. And so you have to unpack that and think about that and the decisions that are made and how you...
Mm. Where did you get to with Philip Morris? Because I just can't see how Philip Morris... Tobacco, where can you get to an argument where tobacco is not a negative?
No, I mean, I can't reconcile it personally. And I don't know if you're following social media right now, but there's an interesting social media storm going on, because I do just feel like they're in an echo chamber at the minute. And so they've come out with some statistics around how they're moving off cigarettes onto vapes and things like this. And I'm just like, that's not better. Just like what strategy is that? So those of us that are working in sustainability, you sort of monitor these organizations curiously to see what they're doing. Hopefully, you know, I would really hope that they change their business model ultimately. I think that's what they're going to have to do in order to survive.
Yeah.
Or they just can't claim to be purpose-led, and you know, that's okay, but just don't claim that you are, and then you know, expect that it makes your customers feel better, because it's just not it's not right.
Yeah, I mean, we're purpose-led, and I think if you're purpose-led, you have to say a few organizations that you're not going to work with, otherwise it's just purpose washing.
Yeah,
tobacco would certainly be one of those for us. In terms of, you spoke about social media there, and of course we're all over social media, and I'm looking at that all the time. But it's in a bit of a flux at the moment, because we think of, you know, it used to be that you could always go to X, and now there's Blue Sky and others.
Yeah.
What's your go-to source of news and information?
It's a timely question, because I've completely come off X now, and I took that decision. I was thinking about it when Roe versus Wade happened in the US, and then there's just been waves of sort of just like abuse, to be honest, that I've been kind of privy to on X. So I've left that platform completely. I've joined Blue Sky. So Blue Sky has been set up as a sort of counter engagement platform to X, and it's part of the founder group of X have created that. At the moment, there's a load of interesting people that I enjoy chatting to and, you know, exchanging dialogue with. So I'm really enjoying Blue Sky, but I hope that it doesn't become an echo chamber. That's my slight worry is that you've got a load of, there's one worldview that appears on X and another worldview that appears on Blue Sky. And then
an echo chamber to me so far. I mean, I've gone on Blue Sky, and most, you know, if I'm just looking at the general look at this, most of it is, this is why, you know, stuff about Musk, stuff about Trump, stuff about, this is what a conservative looks like. It's a reaction to it.
At the moment, I think you're right. Because a lot of the early adopters are those that have left X, right? So you're going to see that in the wave of early adopters. I mean, I'm not engaging with that rhetoric at all, because life's too short. I'm just letting go of that. What I'm finding interesting with Blue Sky is it's where all the sustainability professionals are. So, and I'd be curious whether you're seeing a lot of purpose-led communicators there sharing best practice and this sort of thing. And maybe as a communicator, you need to bridge both. I don't know. But I'm finding that my tribe for insights, constructive criticism, knowledge sharing, is much more dynamically spending time in Blue Sky right now. So I'm spending a lot of time on LinkedIn and Blue Sky.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly, I'm off looking at X for the exact reasons that you stated. And, you know, when, you know, the founder of X, Elon Musk, who has set up the algorithm so that you see his posts more than anything else, when he is stirring up racial hatred and yeah. stirring up abuse against immigrants in the UK and abusing our democratically elected prime minister, that was when I said, okay, this is completely wrong. And also, he's also spreading complete misinformation, not just about that, but about the human population, claiming that there's a decline in population when it's going in exactly the opposite direction. The human population is rising massively. And so just having him run that means that I'm personally off it. I'm out. But interestingly, we did have someone come to us recently, and I know that lots of organizations, especially in the purpose-led space, have said we are off and we're not doing anything on it whatsoever. But I did have someone coming to me, and we represent quite small organizations, that said, I can't afford not to be on all the platforms. So, you know, we haven't made that great big moral jump of saying we're not going to do anything on X ever. Although we're not pushing it, we're not saying, hey, you know, our view is don't bother with it at the moment, and because this is what it looks like. But there's still a huge amount of the audience on there, and it's still much, much bigger than Blue Sky. But
it's interesting. I mean, that's a really interesting assumption there, and one that I'm curious if anyone listening to this would bias bust, because is that right and true? And where you see, so like the other thing that's happening alongside that wave is that we're seeing, particularly in the US, there's some companies, particularly like last mile companies like Harley Davidson, John Deere, etc., that are closing their DEI functions because they're saying that they're performative, so diversity, equity and inclusion functions. And they're leaning into that. They're talking about why they're doing it on X, etc. And it just it's like this weird sort of reverse wokeism, and it's almost performative in the other direction. And I'm finding it very strange to sort of see that unfold.
It is interesting. It's going to be 2025 is going to be an interesting year. I mean, I've seen memes shared saying this is the death of wokeness, going from 2016 to 2024, and you know we're going to see far more of that coming through in 2025. Once the trade barriers start going up in the US, and once Trump is actually in, we see how much we've got already. He's not even in yet. There's going to be this big push away from it, and I suppose if the US suddenly starts to see massive economic growth, there'll be around the world people going, okay, you know, these kind of lines of go woke and go broke and stuff that you hear from the right will continue to some degree. But the thing that I know is that it doesn't matter how much you say that, the climate change issue is not going away in any of our lifetimes. It's
finite, right? You can't avoid that. The air we breathe, the water we drink, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how much you say go woke or go broke. At the end of the day, if you're not dealing with climate change, we're all going broke. We're all, you know, the planet has all the, nature has all the resources that we have. So yeah, it might be a short-term thing. People might think in a very short term, okay, great, I'm making a little bit more money and I've been feeling the pain. But that will always be a very temporary blip. And those of us that have been into sustainability and DE&I and other things for a long time, okay, might see a little small recession in people caring about it, and a bit of a resurgence of the other side, but it's always going to go back. So I'm not seeing it as a long term thing. It's a very short term thing, in my view. Finally, what message would you give to your younger self?
You're braver than you realize. Keep falling forward. Keep being brave.
Beth Knight, Head of Social Sustainability at Lloyds Banking Group. You've been speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose. Thank you for coming on the show. John.